Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up. It's Monday, March 9th, 2026. Welcome to the program. My name is Magnus Tewald.
And I'm Peter Orange.
And we've got a good show for you lined up today. We have a segment that we're from a series we're going to be running this week called Rendezvous Francophonie, which is stories and interviews about the Francophone community here in Canada. We're also going to rerun part of an interview from earlier this year about Aboriginal title. We're going to specifically focus in on the section that explains just what Aboriginal title is. It's something that continues to be in the news with, in the wake of the Couch and Tribes decision last summer, but also a lot of talk about revamping the DRIPA legislation, which is meant, the legislation is meant to ensure that Aboriginal rights are taken into account through all actions of the government. So Aboriginal title is a big part of that. So we're going to replay that interview in a little bit. We have another installment of Gardening with Embark. The series is back on, and we will be talking about some of the different gardening approaches you can use in your garden and what it means for what you'll be doing this summer. What are you going to be talking about today, Peter?
Well, there's a YouTube posting called Confessions of a Former Climate Activist. And what's sort of interesting about this, it runs for about, half an hour. But then she sort of says, oh, I don't believe in being concerned about the actual plastics anymore. So that's sort of interesting that she sort of was very involved with it, believed in it. And now, and then she also questions the plastic bit. Well, the plastics to me are pretty basic because plastic, which was invented in 1909, did not, 1939, the World's Fair, it was sort of introduced to the public. When you look at a lot of collectible toys of the 40s, they tend to be made out of a tin. Mm-hmm. It isn't until the 50s that you get the toys made out of plastic.
Right.
And the problem with plastic is that we should see it as a permanent thing. To have it as a throwaway concept has to really end.
Yeah.
And it has to end at some point. But it's interesting that she said one of her reasons that she said, they said be concerned about plastics, and when COVID happened, there were all the plastic masks and all this, and they were got thrown away, and they said, oh, they were just all these hypocrites. Well, be that as it may, it doesn't take away the concept that plastics are a problem. So I'll be talking about that and a few other things.
All right. That'll be coming up at about just before the end of the program, around 10:45, 10:50. Today. So, you know, the big story dominating the news this week and last week is the war in the Middle East, which seems to be a big giant mess. And so, you know, as I'm sure you're aware, if you're following the news, you know, the United States and Israel working together launched an attack on Iran. Last week, starting on basically Saturday morning our time, or Saturday morning Middle East time in the night, and it's been going nonstop. And perhaps what maybe the U.S. and Israel didn't expect is Iran has also been fighting back pretty strongly with their drones. So we're seeing, of course, U.S. and Israeli attacks throughout throughout Iran, including one on the first day of the attack that, killed the supreme leader. And we're seeing Iran retaliating with attacks not only on U.S. assets and against Israel, but against almost all the sort of U.S. allies in the region, which is most of the countries around there. And by all the reports, you know, the administration, the U.S. administration, hasn't really clearly articulated exactly what their reasons for launching the attack are. They've come up with a whole bunch of things, and they keep this story keeps changing and evolving, or what their goals are. And it seems like at the moment, it's pound Iran until something changes.
Well, the supreme leader, the other thing about that is that Iran actually has two, what they mean by the supreme leader, that is the religious leader.
Yeah.
But the actual political leaders are a separate entity.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, this, I mean, what you got is like killing King Charles or something.
Well, no, but I think well, you know what I mean. The religious leaders really hold much to the power, you know, because they're the ones allied with, you know, who control and are supported and support, you know, the Revolutionary Guard, who are, you know, the armed wing that can enforce their authority. But it's definitely true that Iran is a very interesting, you know, they have this strong, you know, religious leadership, but then they also have much of the workings of a conventional civil society. In that,
that's what I was talking about.
Yeah, you know, they have national elections that elect the political government, but not only at the national level, at a provincial and local level, you know, which is not the case in a lot of authoritarian regimes where, you know, from top to bottom, everybody's kind of appointed by the party or the leader or the dictator. And you don't have a sort of civil society sort of setup that can work. You know, I was hearing a discussion about Egypt in the wake of the Arab Spring 15 years ago now, where, you know, one of the things that, you know, they briefly had elections and one of the problems was the only people who were organized to take advantage of that situation were, you know, religious groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, who in the case of the Egyptian elections won the election, and the only other authority sort of in really organized were the military, and all the rest of the sort of political spectrum, because there had been no civil society under the previous dictatorship, there'd been no opportunity to politically organize and learn the techniques of political organization, were all so unprepared and therefore weak that there wasn't really a system to hold on to. And, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood won, and once the military decided they didn't like him, they got, you know, overthrown and straight back into a dictatorship. As Iran, you know, offers some hope that it has enough of a civil society sort of in place that when the opportunity presents itself, they might really be able to set up something that is perhaps a functioning democratic series. But I don't think that's going to come about through bombing.
Well, with the second Iraqi war, 2003, they had a leader, Saddam Hussein. Now, the problem was they won it, but then it was what happened to the society afterwards. With Iran, they don't even have that because they have you. I mean, I guess in Iraq, he didn't have a civic society in a way. He wasn't really a religious leader.
He was a dictator.
Yeah.
And he controlled.
So Iran has something different that just that they must have thought, oh, we'll kill this guy. It'll be fine. No, they have more of a backup, and they're going to have nepotism because he's the son of the guy that was killed. Will be then. The other thing, I'd like to bring up something that I did 2 years ago on this show,
yep,
which was Mazadek. That
right.
was the early 50s.
Yeah, that was the
Prime Minister of Iran.
Yeah, who was elected and whatnot, and was not in the favor of the oil companies of the U.S. and Britain. And
yes, and then they overthrew him with the help of the United States and England, and put in the Shah, which was not that good. And it's a real tragedy because Mao Zedong, if he had been allowed to stay, I think a lot of secularization would have taken place in the Middle East. You know, I mean, it would have just been more of a more progressive place in general. But what happens, they say, well, look at when you actually try to appease them through diplomacy and whatever. Look at what happened to Mao Zedong. Now, if I were a prime minister or president, I would say to Iran, it was wrong for doing that. And Mao Zedong was actually a vowed government. It was wrong to. That doesn't mean I say from 1979 to now you are doing everything I like. Mm-hmm. But no president, no prime minister have ever said that to Iran. You know, which is interesting. Anyway,
I don't know that it would be enough, but it'd be a step.
It's just something I would do, whether it would mean anything. But it's just, as I said, it was actually President Eisenhower and Prime Minister Winston Churchill are responsible, basically. It's their fault.
So it's at this point, it's really hard to see where this current war is going to go. Partly, a lot of it is the lack of clarity about why exactly did they feel the need to start the war and start it now. By that, I mean Israel and the United States. But also, you know, there's so much lack of clarity about their goals, you know, because that seems to shift a lot. And what's actually achievable, you know? I mean, I think there's no example, as they say, of regime change just through bombing. And, you know, so that's not going to happen. So are we just going to keep on bombing until we turn Iran into a pile of rubble? And how's that aiding anyone?
I think the Trump administration and Donald Trump himself thought they would win by now. That's the problem. They're crackpots. They're crackpots at just about every level, including this.
Mm-hmm.
And they are in panic because they don't know what to do.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the one thing, you know, given Trump and how Trump operates and the blind loyalty of his supporters, who he seems to be able to say and do anything, you know, he could at some point, at a random point, go, okay, we've had enough. We're going to stop. We're going to declare victory based on whatever criteria we come up with, whether that's real or not. They're just, oh, well, we destroyed we degraded their military. And then they'll just turn and move on to the next problem. And they won't be held accountable in real terms, it seems, for that could happen. I mean, I wouldn't, in a normal administration, you know, people would be, I mean, they are kind of freaking out, but, you know, there'd be so much outrage at getting involved in a war where you don't seem to know why you're doing it or what you want to get out of it, which, based on the sort of lack of clarity in their statements so far, seems to be the case. You know, I mean, at some point they can turn, you know, Trump, and he seems to get away with this stuff, can turn that to his advantage and say, okay, we're done, we win. His reporters go, yay, we won.
That would be the best scenario.
It would be.
But they're just terrible at every level. No, in a
yep.
serious way.
And we're seeing the evidence of that with this. And, you know, already we're seeing gas prices go up, the stock market go down, you know, lots of impacts on trade. And those effects, I mean, not specifically those effects, but the economic impact of this on the world economy and how it is not going to end just the day the war ends, whatever ending the war means or looks like. Because it creates shockwaves.
How much credibility? Like, what do you think they were all saying? Oh, they're going to build the hydrogen bomb. What do you know about that background? How plausible?
Well, you know, I only know what I've you know, heard and read in the media about it. Here's the thing. You know, every time. either Iran or the United States or whoever runs into and decides they need to bomb Iran, part of the justification is always, well, you know, they're only just a week away from doing the thing. Somebody said that last week. Oh, they're just about a week away. But, you know, was it 6 months ago or 8 months ago when Iran, they did a previous bombing and they declared that they'd completely destroyed and degraded the Iranian nuclear program. And at that time, they said they're a week away. And then, you know, there are clips of Israel Netanyahu and others. You can go back 20 years. They're a week away. They're a week away from this program.
And then, then you have Israel, who does have the hydrogen bomb. And never public, and they never officially say they do, but everybody knows they have it.
So, I mean, I on the one hand, I understand why Iran would want to have a nuclear program as a deterrent, but at the same time, it seems to create a lot more problems for them by creating this endless justification for to be attacked. That they would be better off, you know, they'd be better off putting their energy just publicly saying we're not even bothering to go there anymore. So bugger off and leave us alone. And, you know, putting their efforts into conventional weapons that they can use to defend themselves. Sorry?
Well, maybe not even conventional weapons. Just, I don't know. It's a mess. It's a mess.
Definitely a mess. All right. Well, it's not a mess. It's going to go away. I think you will find coming up at 11 o'clock when Democracy Now! Starts that they will be digging into this very deeply. So please stick around for that. As you know, Amy Goodman can get a lot of really great experts and people connected to information and experience in the region. So stay tuned for that. They're going to be, I think they'll have some interesting information and talks and stuff to go on there. We're going to head into our profile for the Rendezvous Francophonie series. It is... we're celebrating Francophone speakers across Canada this month. This is a series produced through our national organization, the National Campus Community Radio Association. And you'll be hearing more from this series here on Speak Ups throughout the month. Today we are have an interview Francophone athlete Catherine Plouf.
Le Rendezvous de la Francophonie is back for 2026. My name is Catherine Fisher, and I interviewed 8 Canadians for the Franco podcast. In this episode, I spoke with professional basketball player and 2-time Olympian Catherine Plouf. Catherine grew up in Edmonton and still calls the city home. She is one of 2 spokespeople for the Rendezvous de la Francophonie this year. Catherine spoke to me about her French learning journey, what she loves about sport, and about having a heart set of curiosity. Here's our conversation. Catherine, what languages do you speak and how did you learn them?
I speak English by birth and how I was raised. I'm in an English-speaking environment for most of my life, all the time. And French came into my life because I was living in France playing professional basketball. And outside of our French class that we took in junior high school, I didn't really have much exposure to being in a French environment at all. I have an aunt and uncle who both are French-speaking. Well, my uncle's from central northern Quebec. So when I was growing up and quite young, he was like my French uncle. So he was the one who spoke French. Most of the time, I didn't understand what he was saying because his accent was very strong. And but out of love, like I just loved him because he was a fun, jovial guy. And their daughter, so my cousin, who was around the same age as myself, and she was French-speaking as well because they raised her bilingual. So I thought that was pretty cool. But other than that, didn't really get around French language consistently until I went to France. So I was playing overseas there for about 7 years and in different cities around France. But in my first year there, I wanted to learn the language because I knew I might be there for a while. So I really tried to, you know, ask my club, like, can I get a tutor? Can I get a tutor? And so about halfway through the season, so about three or four months in, got a tutor, was trying to learn the basics, the vocabulary, basics of, you know, having conversation, and tried to learn my best since then. So it obviously got better. I was around a lot of English speaking people, even my teammates the first couple of years. So I had to be quite intentional to tell them, like, hey, speak French to me. Like, I need to learn this. As you know, it can be like, it's harder when you're just not around the language on a consistent basis and speaking it. You know, you got to learn through the struggle. So that's how I learned French, and very grateful that I was around people who were encouraging me of that, and that I, you know, put the effort in, because it doesn't come through osmosis, that's for sure. So I'm not like fluent by any Francophone by birth means, but I'm very grateful I can speak the language now.
So your great grandparents were French Canadian. What do you know of their stories?
Yes, not a whole lot. I do know, I was talking with my dad about this recently, and my mom, just about different languages in their family. And I believe my great-grandparents, when they came to Alberta, I know that they didn't speak French with their kids, so they never taught their kids. They were more like, okay, we're going to be part of the English culture now, which I'm like, okay, didn't get that passed on. But interesting to hear about. I don't know a lot about their story being here in Alberta. I think a lot of their family that I know from what my dad's told me, they were in Bonnyville and St. Paul area in Alberta. So there's actually quite a lot of Ploofs there from what I hear. I've met some second cousins, uncles and such who are from there. And sometimes I meet people who are Ploofs just in random passing. Honestly, that's happened to me twice, where I've just started a conversation with someone. They've ended up to be related to me. And I'm like, wow, that is fascinating. When I was living in France one year, I had met an older gentleman who was asking me where I'm from, like I'm not quite sure if I was speaking French in this conversation or not. I probably was, but anyways, had a conversation. He's like, oh, Plouf, that sounds like a French name. I'm like, yeah, it is. And prior to this year I was there, my grandma, who was a Selahub, but she married into the Plouf. So not my grandpa Plouf, but grandma. She was telling me that Plouf, prior to Plouf's living in France, were from Germany, and it could have been a Bloof that came to France and became Plouf. And I was like, well, that is super interesting. So I told this story to this gentleman because he was asking about the history of my name. And I was like, you know what? My grandma said it could have been a Bloof before France Plouf. He's like, oh, okay. Didn't see this man for probably 4 months, maybe three months. Next time I ran into him, he pulled out a piece of paper from his pocket, and it was a Wikipedia page of Jean something Plouf. And it had kind of like I forget what it said about this man, but he would have gone to Quebec. And so there was a sub text in this bio too, that was like also common or also referred to as a Bloof from German. And I was like, oh my gosh. So he looked up my family tree.
That's dedication.
Yeah.
How has speaking more than one language enriched your life?
Oh, it is. I'm a person who I love connection. Like, I think that is very fulfilling for me to meet people, to hear their stories, to get to know them as a human being. And one of the main reasons why I started to learn French was so I could connect with my teammates who didn't speak English. And they were the younger girls at the time, probably in high school age. And I just wanted to know them. So for me, it's just another open door to connection and to knowing people closer and deeper, which I really value. And that's very enriching when you get to connect with people and have a desire to. It's a tool at the end of the day, but it also allows you to know a little bit about their culture through language, obviously. So that's very enriching for me. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess it also is probably opens different sort of options, like becoming the spokesperson for the Rendezvous with Francophonie as well.
Yeah.
Clearly you would not be if you didn't speak French.
Yes.
So as you know, the theme of this year's Rendezvous de la Francophonie is activate your Francophonie. How do you activate your Francophonie in your everyday life?
Well, a couple things. I think the theme, which is cool, I'm a sports person. So, action and activity is kind of what it's in my daily routine. And I think the theme in general is to activate like all parts of who we are, you know, like activate what comes from within us, activate the things that are on our hearts, on our minds to live out. And those are our values at the end of the day of what's important to us. And like, once again, for Les Rendezvous de la Francophonie, it's for, say for everyone, it's for everyone, you know? And I think it's just an example of like sharing who you are. It's an opportunity for French people across Canada to share who they are with everyone and for everyone to have an opportunity to either get to know people through events, through conversation, whatever it is, because connection is at the heart of unity. You know, we can be diverse, but united. So like diverse in how we look, what we like, what we enjoy, but united in value of connection and, you know, bridging a gap across different kind of thinking. We could be united in love. So activating that, going back to the theme, is I think just activating your values and a desire to connect with different people across Canada. And that's been really cool. It's obviously a play on words for me as a basketball person because I am active, but sport is such a great example of that. Like different culture events like music, theater, all these kinds of things. Like the action is and sport is very unifying because we're going after a common goal. So yet we're all these different people from different places who have like different personalities, all these kinds of things. We have a common goal to be our best and pursue excellence in our sport. And that's what I love about sport is that we meet people across so many different I get to meet people across so many different backgrounds. And it's when we get on the court and get to play, there's such a respect for each other, for the sport and for us bringing our best. And, you know, the results are going to be the results, but competition at its heart is two people or two teams sharpening each other. So getting into the arena to be excellent, and you can't have your best without the opponent. And so there's a respect for each other there. But yeah, that's how I'm going to do that. Sorry, I diverged from activation.
No, it's, I love it. And yeah, it's great that you, as a professional athlete, that you will see a lot of the world. So it's such an opportunity.
Yeah.
March is the month of the Francophonie, of course. How can the Francophonie continue to grow and flourish?
I think this goes back to like an individual expression of people and who they are. So just being in like inviting people in through relationship, inviting people in through different events and conversations. I don't think that has to, we have to wait for whole organization or system or something in place for us to flourish and grow. I think we can always, I always encourage people to do it on an individual basis, and that's how everyone grows. So a rising tide raises all ships. I really love that quote where when one person grows, it kind of lifts up everyone around them. And so, yeah, I think just being open to curiosity, because when people hear French language, you know, or any other different language, people are curious. I don't think they're as judgmental as we put people out to be. There's a curiosity when we hear something different or new, because we're like, what is that? Like when I first started to hear the Quebec French language, I was like, do not understand what they're saying, because I was learning more of the France French accent. But it was curious because I was like, how does that even happen when it's the same language, but different accents? Like, it was so curious, but it was curiosity. So I think like being open to people being curious and reframing our brain like, okay, people can be curious. They're not judging us. And I think that's at the heart of it. That's how we help anything grow, is to take that